Hi, I'm Adrian. And right this moment, there are tens of thousands of Black entrepreneurs around the world creating amazing startups that you've never heard about. For some reason, the mainstream media doesn't cover Black entrepreneurs as much as it should. But on this show, we find these amazing founders. We sit down with them. We figure out how they got their ideas launched, what their struggles were, what they're afraid of, what drives them. My hope is that you have enough firepower from listening to this show to go out there and start your own business. Or if you're working on something, continue plowing through it. Let's have an amazing time together. Welcome to the show.
Okay, so today I'm talking to a very interesting founder, Gabriel Cepeda. And I got to tell you, like, when I first saw the promo video for the startup called Use Pickups, and I was pretty much sure I was watching like a proper, you know, Fortune 500 commercial, because it was done so perfectly well. And eventually, you know, it ended, and then I got a sense of that, hey, this is actually a startup. And that was super interesting. So Gabriel, for everybody listening, you know, what is Pickups?
So, yeah, well, first off, thank you for having me on your podcast and giving me the opportunity to talk about the company. Really excited about the stuff we're doing. And to answer your question, Pickups is a community marketplace. Basically, we bring together online shoppers with their neighbors to ship their packages. Today, you have a situation in large cities like New York City, like where you shop online and you get a package delivered, usually when you're not home. More often than not, these packages are left in the lobbies of non-doorman apartment buildings, where they're stolen, they're damaged, they're lost, a variety of things can go wrong. Then, you know, you're forced as a consumer to, you know, take the long trip over to the post office and then get in line with 60 or 70 other people that have the same problem. So it's a big mess, and Pickups is here to take this sort of community approach to solving the problem.
So an interesting thing about the service is that you're actually using neighbors to actually store these packages. So it's not like you have an office or you have a warehouse or anything. How did you get people to say yes to that?
Yeah, so believe it or not, the sharing economy, the start of the sharing economy really made it, has made our process a lot easier. And I say this because movements that were created in terms of community and collaboration by companies like Uber or Airbnb have opened up, have sort of broken down a lot of the walls of uncomfortableness a lot of people have when it comes to working with strangers. You know, Uber did that for transportation, where people would just get into their car, ran into the cars of random people. Airbnb, literally, you let random people into your home. I mean, the barriers have been broken completely. So today's generation of consumers or of citizens in these large cities is very different from 30, 40 years ago. And so the concept of getting people simply to, you know, receive a package and store it in some extra space they have in their apartment is really a no-brainer, mainly because people are willing to rent out their entire apartment to random strangers, taking advantage of some extra space in your closet, your living room, or your bedroom to make a few extra bucks and be a great neighbor. It's not something that has been incredibly difficult. I think we've entered the very unique sort of stage in society where now is this concept of space arbitrage, where everybody's trying to find creative ways to utilize extra space. You know, I believe it's some statistic like 90% of a vehicle's potential space usage is never utilized because most people drive mm-hmm. their cars by themselves. Right. And then in terms of people's apartments, when you think about all the extra stuff people have, most of it can be thrown out. So there's a lot of useless space, you know, in our homes, in our vehicles and everything. And so Pickups is able to allow you to monetize some of that extra space. And the average package size is relatively small. You're talking about something that would store a laptop or roughly the same. The boxes that are used to store electronics are the same sizes of the boxes that are used to ship apparel. So there's a relatively simple guideline of box sizes that we can communicate with neighbors.
So run me through the process of how it works, right? So I go to Amazon, I order a package, and, you know, what happens next, right?
Yeah, so right now, our version one of our product works in the form of a browser extension, focused right now on version one of that version one being just Google Chrome. essentially you would download the browser extension after receiving an invite from us to do so, because right now we're invite only on our platform. And so you would get the link to download our browser extension. That browser extension will work with any online store. Our number one focus, obviously, is making sure that it is most custom made for Amazon stores to start, mainly because Amazon is obviously 50% of the marketplace of every online, every dollar that moves online, 50% of the dollars are from Amazon. So Amazon has been our number one focus for now. But essentially, you download the browser extension. Now, when you get to the shopping cart of let's say Amazon as an example, instead of typing in your own shipping information, you would click on your browser extension, on the pickups browser extension, and then you would say, you click on a button that says, "Hey, I need a neighbor." And instantaneously, the little wheel starts to turn and it would find somebody that matches your schedule availability, which you will have already provided to us when you first signed up, an address that works for you. So you provide us what we call important places. So you would show us a place like your home, where you work, favorite coffee shop. So neighbors aren't necessarily people that just live next to where you live. They're people that are next to a place that matters to you. So we would match you in the same way you'd find an Uber driver. We'd match you with somebody that meets those requirements and that sort of filter of neighbors. And then the address information in your Amazon shopping cart is then instantaneously filled out with that of a neighbor. And the tracking information is then shared. It's a lot of custom code was written to allow for that kind of integration. But that's how it works. And then you finalize your checkout process and that package goes ahead and gets sent to the pickup's neighbor. At this stage right now, we connect neighbors and shoppers via SMS. So you really just are connected through a chatbot that we wrote that allows us to almost sort of be in the middle between both you and your neighbor, for total communication, 24/7 support as well. And that's essentially how it works right now. Our goal in the next, I would say, 90 days to 120 days is to be in a position where now there'll be a mobile app, both for iOS and Android, that shoppers and neighbors can use, where you can communicate through the app entirely. We'll phase out SMS. Ultimately, our goal is also to phase out the Chrome extension, where it will be more of a strategic partnership with retailers so that you would find us in the shopping cart of any online store. Instead of having to download anything. So that's where we will be. That's full transparency, not much of a secret there, but a great way to sort of get people comfortable with the idea of the platform and using it on a consistent basis is to allow them to try it out with different extensions and use it on when they need to use it.
Okay. I mean, you seem like you have a definite roadmap mapped out. So you clearly have a vision of where things are going, but mm-hmm. I want to take things back to the start. How did you come about this problem? Is it something that you experienced? You know, you just, you know, walking around this one day, something hits you in the head and you're like, you know what? I'm going to build a sharing economy marketplace for packages, right? That's what I'm going to do. You know, is this something that's native to New York or Brooklyn? You know, how did this get started?
Well, to answer your first question about the how it got started, I think the cliche answer that most entrepreneurs give is like, I personally experienced this problem and I had to go solve it. And that's super cliche. I think it wasn't like that for me. I did experience the problem, ironically enough, along the time that I was searching for it. But I did not. It wasn't like it just hit me in the head and I was like, I just got to go do this. I don't think I woke up that passionate about package theft. I don't think anybody does, really. honest, I don't think it's like, that's not how it works, at least not for me. I think what really motivated me were my search for a higher purpose. You know, I've been pursuing entrepreneurship and sort of creating my own ideas and projects and businesses since I was a kid. Created my first business in seventh grade. It was a lunchroom accounting software to help speed up the lunchroom lines in the cafeteria, mainly because all the cool kids side of the cafeteria. I was a pretty big nerd, so I didn't sit on that side. And they usually got to the front of the line fastest because they were closest. And so I thought if you could create a system where, you know, pretty much like you'd swipe your ID or you swipe a lunchroom debit card, it was called the meal card system. And you could, you know, swipe and it would get rid of the whole cash and probably speed up the lines. Little did I know this already existed in colleges. You would just swipe your ID. But at the time I was like, my research skills weren't that great. So I spent about a year building that. I mentioned that because I've always been passionate about solving problems in some way. And I would say about a year ago, a little over a year now, I was searching for something. I know I wanted to focus on creating an idea that would impact people around the world. That's my focus, my long-term goal. I want to create ideas that can impact people across industries. It doesn't matter what it is. And so I thought, where should I focus? And right now, you know, the United Nations came out with a sustainability report that talks about 10 billion people being on the earth by 2050. A lot of people don't think about this because they're like, 2050 is such a far time away. Why should I care? People care about putting food on their table tomorrow, right? But this is something that I will experience. I will be alive, you know, it'll be in my lifetime that I will be around such a population. And so what I ended up also finding out was that 70% out of those 10 billion people are expected to live in a city. So New York City today has about 8 million residents, 1.6 million people on the island of Manhattan. Imagine 2 or 3 million more people. Imagine what life would be like, even more congested, even more chaotic. And that's not a question of if it's going to happen, it's a question of when. And so I started to focus on that. I said, okay, I'm gonna now dig deep into finding an idea that I know can impact the key sectors that allow a city to function, like logistics, telecommunications, energy, waste management. There are a variety. I could go on for days about all the key areas of that allow a city to function, to thrive. And then one of those happened to be logistics. Around that time, I also happened to be in the city. I was biking around the city and I noticed there was a lobby in a building. And in the lobby, there were packages stacked floor to ceiling. And I'm a nosy person. So I walked inside and I asked the doorman, I was like, hey man, so like, how many packages, you guys just getting a big shipment today or something? And he's like, no, these are tenants. I was like, what? And he tells me that we easily get 200 to 300 packages a day sometimes. And I thought, wow, that is ridiculous. You know, like how is this? That's why I was completely shocked by the fact that just that many people can have boxes in a single apartment building. And then it's funny because like when something happens, all of a sudden now you notice it everywhere. So then I started to notice in other buildings, it was the same thing. And then I started to see between the hours of 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., you go around Midtown Manhattan, and it's just rows and rows and rows of FedEx trucks, UPS trucks, and delivery trucks. And that's when I started to dig deeper into the industry and realize, wow, this is a real problem. Shipping carriers are losing millions and millions of dollars a year simply because you're not home, and a lot of other logistical inefficiencies. Retailers lose money because packages are stolen and they have to go and absorb that cost to send you, you know, a new item in an effort to preserve brand loyalty. So it just kind of keeps spiraling from there. And that's when I started to realize I needed to work on this problem. And so the idea originated as a network of parcel lockers. It was supposed to be Amazon Locker, but better located. I thought Amazon lockers weren't necessarily located in the best of places. So I thought, why not put them in the lobbies of buildings that are conveniently located along the routes that you take as a commuter every day. And that's what I wanted to do. But then I realized I was low resource having, aka broke, young entrepreneur who could not go ahead and like travel to China to negotiate with locker manufacturers to create lockers and all this stuff. So I was like, what is the simplest, cheapest, easiest, most efficient way for me to bring this to life? And I thought, why not replace the lockers with people and let people do the work and simply being a community and working together? And that's where I started to realize that this actually would be more of a neighborhood, you know, building type of platform than anything else. And that's how it's continued to evolve.
Yeah, it sounds like the natural progression of finding out good ideas. But I think that one thing that you touched on there is that, you know, the modern day entrepreneur is very much about making a difference in the world at the same time, creating efficient processes or a system. But how did you identify that this was a good idea? I mean, there's a lot of ideas that I could probably come up with right now that have a place where they could potentially change how we do things or how we work. But how did you zero in on this particular idea? Like how big is this problem? Did you look at the size? Did you look at how many people were complaining about this? As much as it's a big problem, there's a lot of things that's a big problem complain about it, but they don't necessarily need new solutions. So how did you distill that, hey, this problem is a pretty good one to work on. I'm going to spend, you know, the next 10 years of my life working on packages, right? How did you get to that
point? Well, not losing focus of my long-term goal. And I think it's to impact cities. And I think you have to look at the fact that this is a market that's literally in its infant stages. Less than 10% of all retail sales in America happen online. And yet you would think it'd be the opposite because of how much we talk about shopping online, how big of a problem it is. You would think it's like this crazy thing. But meanwhile, we're literally at 10%. And yet it's a $518 billion market that's grown at 20% every year, like guaranteed over the last 3 to 4, you know, years. And that's just here in America. You know, it's a 2.4, I think, trillion dollar market abroad. And again, still in its infant stages, too. So that's number one. If you want to look at it purely from a business standpoint, it's at the beginning. And one of the best times to determine whether or not a problem is going to grow in size is to view it based on its impact right now. So if it's at 10% of all retail sales, and, you know, as according to New York Times, with the 90,000 packages being stolen every day in New York City, if that's at the stage, that's where we're at right now, you know, at 10%, where are we going to be at 20% or 30% or when everybody lives online, essentially, you know, and that's where we're headed. So that's something that was, that also is very reassuring of, as to why this problem was something that was worth focusing on at the moment. At the same time, the population growth is a very guaranteed metric we're going to hit. It's not something that is speculative or like, well, maybe the population will grow. No, we are reaching that point. Cities, people are gravitating and moving more closer to urban environments. It is the future. And so the concept of these mega cities that people used to talk about, like that's the future and like it'll be in the, only in the movies. Mega cities are coming, you know, these massive centers. It's inevitable. And so I don't know. It's hard to say because I feel like it's just a feeling you have. Maybe that's where the gambling side of entrepreneurship is. Or the only one that sees, you know, the inevitable, so to speak, and you're the only one that believes in that vision. So I don't know. I guess maybe that's where it can. Maybe it's a hunch. But I think there are several metrics. There's a lot of data around why this is a problem that's going to continue to grow. And I also want to emphasize, it's not about packages. It's packages is just the method by which we're operating at the moment. I think the greater concept revolves around getting people to work together and getting the things that they need in general. Whether we enter the fulfillment space one day, whether we enter the, you know, general delivery space one day, who knows? But right now, I think packages and all that is the focus. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily, it's not what motivates us.
Gotcha. So talk about motivation. I think that as entrepreneurs, you have to be extremely motivated, especially as a founder. And to get anything started is very difficult, right? A lot of people have great ideas. You know, they talk about it with their friends. You know, they'll have it down in a notebook for years and never get done. But you were able to build an MVP very quickly, ship it out, and actually get people using it. You know, how did you navigate that space? I mean, how did you go from idea to initial product to actually getting it in the hands of the first users? And you kind of walk me through that phase and how you were able to achieve that so quickly, because you did it very quickly. You moved very, very fast, which is very impressive.
Yeah, so we're still in our early stages. You know, as much as I guess we give the appearance that we're like so far down the road or something, and that's great if we have. I don't know if we have, but we're still very much in our early stages. You know, we're only available to Williamsburg, Brooklyn area right now, New York City, you know, operating a very closely monitored and analyzed, a base of users and whatnot. I think we've done a lot of, to speak to the current stage that we're in right now, I think we've done a lot of grassroots. We took a very grassroots approach to growing the network and growing everything. I think personally, I've been out there putting in flyers. I've met with people in coffee shops. I've onboarded just about 80% to 90% of the neighbors we have on our platform in person. So a lot of things that you can't do at scale, you know, with a million users, you do now with, you know, a lot less people. So that's been something that's helped us to move quickly. Believe it or not, when I first started working on this idea, you have to remember, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a designer by trade. I am an idea guy. I'm really good at creating ideas. I'm passionate about them. I can spend 18 hours a day sitting behind my whiteboard or my notebook and just journaling and creating ideas. So the difficult, while that's great, that doesn't help you when you're trying to build a tech company, because you have to have the ability to actually bring the things that you're brainstorming on. You have to have the ability to bring them to life. And I don't have that. I could create as many websites as I want, but it was going to be really hard for me to do anything else. What ended up really helping us was, believe it or not, was the approach that I learned from looking into Dropbox, Dollar Shave Club, Airbnb. A lot of these companies took a non-conventional approach of make as much noise as possible about your product before it's really even fully finished, and then leverage that to spark growth. And that's for those companies, it was a growth hack. For me, it was a survival hack. It was more like pickups will not exist if I don't go out and get people excited about what we're building first. Or in this case, as we're building it, and as it's growing and whatnot. So this is what the approach I took. It was more like, okay, let me go actually and focus on content first and noise. and then develop the product. And so I, the first guy I looked for, ironically enough, I first dude that came on was a content guy, a filmmaker. He's still a part of our company. He's our content director right now. And his focus was to create content, create commercials. And the focus was to create our first commercial. We did that commercial for $800 on a credit card. You know, it wasn't like we had some crazy funding for it. I got a bunch of volunteers, and those volunteers showed up with their own equipment and state-of-the-art equipment on top of that. And, you know, the actors were easy because the whole team pretty much acted in the video, and I was the main actor there. So, like, it was a relatively easy thing. Not easy. It was a lot of hard work, but we knocked it out in 48 hours. You know, we took some time to edit and put a whole thing together. I have a mentor on the team that's been a mentor to me since I was 14 years old. And he's a two-time Emmy Award-winning producer and editor. So his vision and guidance helped us to really keep things in the right direction as well. And then we pumped that out and we started sending it all over the place. I realized it was great to get more hyper-local growth instead of trying to target all of New York City, which is hard. I would rather target one specific neighborhood. You know, Williamsburg's got 150,000 people. And for those 150,000 people, there's like one functioning post office. So it's like you already have a challenge there. And a huge portion of Williamsburg is you know, lives online and they're millennials and all that. So these are things that you start to focus in on. And it helped me to form the strategy to form our growth strategy. And here we are today.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you that next. I was like, man, that the video looked pretty damn good. You know, did you just cook that up? Because if that was just shot with your phone, I was like, man, you know, I need that. First of all, I need that cell phone juice. And secondly, the script was just perfectly done. I was like, man, this is really good. But one thing that you mentioned right now is focus on hyperlocal, right? I think that as a founder, when doing a startup, everybody wants to go global. Right. I mean, I'm sure you lay in bed and you tell yourself, you know, man, this thing is going to be big one day. You know, it's probably going to be everywhere. But I think it's very important to start hyperlocal. Right. Mm-hmm. But foresight like that, I mean, doesn't come natural to a lot of people who jump in entrepreneurship. Right. So for your journey, I mean, have you been through an accelerator of any sort? You know, were you in the tech space by any chance? Were you in the startup world? You know, how did you acquire that initial knowledge that, you know, you have to at least know of to get something like this off the ground?
Yeah, no, I've never been part of any sort of accelerator or previous, like, you know, organized startup. My first job was at a restaurant as a busboy. I don't think I've ever actually had experience working in startups. One thing I can say is a couple of things. I'm 23 years old. You know, I've been creating since I was 13 years old. I don't think I've gone a single month during the last, you know, 10 years, if that adds up. Yeah, 10 years. I have not gone a single month in the last 10 years without running a business. I've had something going, whether it was I've gotten used to the idea of if something's not working, I try to fix it. There's a pivot. But ironically enough, around the same time, I find something better. And I quickly move on to the next thing. So I've been consistently researching, studying. I read usually a book a week or a book every 2 weeks. So I'm finding something to read. I'm very much a student. You know, I was always a terrible student in school, but like outside of the classroom, like I'm very much into learning as much as I can. I do believe that building an extensive list of mentors helped tremendously as well. Because I would reach out to people online and just say, hey, I'm 16 years old, I'm 17 years old, I'd love to pick your brain on this or that. And then they would respond because everybody's like, oh my God, I wish you were my son. And I'm like, no, you really don't, because I'm not the best in the world. But so believe it or not, I know this may sound a little weird, but when you're 17 years old and you're sort of able to carry yourself a certain way that maybe people might say, oh, he's so mature, he's so this, they open up doors for you. They're like, oh, let's talk, you know, come by my office or whatever. And next thing you know, you're at the office on like, you're like on the 25th floor of some Wall Street building meeting with some VP who then introduces you to all his colleagues and all their colleagues introduce you to their colleagues. And it just continues to spiral from there. So I never once, you know, it's not like I went to an Ivy League school and then like my professor was some VC investor. Like I know a lot of guys or whatever, that's not how it worked out for me at all. I've literally just networked online through cold emails. Google's like my best friend. I just have so many saved links and research and stuff that I just keep going and digging deeper into articles and research that taught me most of what I know. Another thing that I also would mention is that it's just finessing your way into events, believe it or not. Like I have gone into so many events I probably should not be at. It's ridiculous. I have just events with $500 tickets, $1,000 per person tickets or whatever. And I've just emailed the director and like, hey, I can't afford this ticket price, but I'd love the opportunity to be there. And they're like, oh my God, of course. Here's two free tickets. And that's literally how I've gotten into these events. And I'm in some like black tie, you know, fancy dinner gala or whatever. And I'm sitting next to a VP at JP Morgan or something. And I'm just talking about what I'm doing. And that person says, you know what, this is great. Why don't you come by my office and let's talk more? And then I show up with 10 or 20 questions and they answer things for me. And that's literally how every relationship I have today, that's how I've gotten all of them. Most of what I know has been from either A, researching, which I do for like literally all hours of the night. Sometimes I go to bed at 5:30 in the morning just Googling stuff. So it's come from that. It's come from mentors that I've picked up along the way. And then it's come from going to events. And those three things, I'm sorry, and then the last one is reading, because I do read a lot. So those things are really what allowed me to learn most of the things that I know. I'm sorry, I sort of rambled there, but that's really kind of summed it up.
Yeah, I mean, you said some key things there. I think just to sort of sum that up, I would say that, especially being a founder trying to build a startup, good percentage of us are kind of broke at the start. And, you know, you really have to be scrappy
kind of
things. Well, look, I'm trying to be modest here, man.
Like, No, I'm totally honest.
But, you know, the one thing that you cannot escape is being resourceful, right? Yeah. You know, a lot of people talk about, oh, we need more resources and stuff. But, you know, 90% of the time, you just need to be more resourceful. You know, you have to sort of think outside of the box. And that's why it's hard. It's not hard because the problems that you're trying to solve are, you know, calculus related, or, you know, you're not trying to solve, you know, a math theorem problem. It's just, how do I use what I have to get what I need, right? And I think that's very critical, and it seems like you've mastered that side of things very well. But to get started, you kind of need money, right? So how did you get started on that? I mean, did you have savings? How did you put that together?
No, actually, So before this business, I was in the nightlife business. That's how I paid a lot of, you know, tuition costs with college while I was in school. And I was doing concert production. So I would bring together the investors. I would contract the venue, book artists, promoters, advertising. I pretty much do everything. Me and my partner at the time, I was 19 or 20. And so I did that for about 3 years. And that gave me a little bit of experience in talking to investors. Not the type of VCs you deal with in startups, because they're about vision and long-term goal. Whereas in the nightlife business, about, okay, I'm giving you 20 grand. What are you going to do with it? You bring me back 40. You know, it's like, it's very straightforward about cash, bottle service and ticket sales. It's very straightforward. So that gave me the experience over the course of 3 years for both good and bad. It gave me the experience of learning how to do the numbers, which helps you to talk to investors and be more sort of straightforward to the point. The reason I mentioned that is because it sort of led to me being more resourceful with cash, because I made a lot of mistakes in that business that cost a lot of financial losses and whatnot in taking this like long-term startup approach into the nightlife, which is short-term. So I learned that. And then when I got out of that business, I needed a quick way to just give me flexibility and also some cash. So I started working in restaurants, bartending, busboy, host, do different things. And that actually is all the money that I used to pay for the early expenses of pickups. It's been entirely funded from little part-time jobs that I've had. You know, it would be wrong to not mention my parents' help too. You know, that bus ride, that MTA ride, that, you know, using their car to get around to meetings and anything I got to do. Like, my parents have 100% supported me there. But most of everything was bootstrapped and has been bootstrapped for my own little side hustles and part-time jobs. It's also important to mention my mentor literally said, hey man, I have a credit card, you know, it's got a good limit on it. You know, he's a professional, makes good money and all that. So he was like, listen, I'm 100% in with you. Here's a credit card. You just pay the monthly bill on it and use that credit card to incorporate and to trademark and to pay for your early launch expenses and different things you got to do. And that's literally how it's been. And we're currently in the process of raising in a formal round of funding, but everything has been bootstrapped completely.
Okay. So how much are you looking to raise, actually?
So right now, we're raising a couple $100,000 for a pre-seed round. And that's just to get us to first base in terms of really scaling other neighborhoods within New York City. The good thing about our platform is that we're very much our mentality is revolves around being bootstrapped. So we think outside the box. We're very resourceful, as you've seen from day one. It's not like I sat down thinking, where am I going to get it? Go get $1 million so I could start this. It was more like, how are we just going to start this with $2 and then go from there? So, you know, it's interesting to see that you may not necessarily, sometimes you don't actually need as much money as you think to execute the most basic of what you need to do. And so we're currently raising a few $100,000 in a pre-seed round to get us to first base and then go from there.
So there's this big trend in the startup world where, you know, you have independent startups now, indie startups that, you know, the founders of those startups build their platforms, they build software, and they essentially just bootstrap it to success, to profitability. You know, they might not be doing $1 million, you know, MRR, a monthly recurring revenue, but they're doing 20 grand and there's two guys working from home or two ladies working from home, and they're happy with that. When you started this, obviously you thought about the money side and the revenue side of things. You know, what was your vision around that for you personally, and not necessarily about, you know, about the business or how big it can get? You know, what do you personally want out of the entrepreneurship journey?
Sorry, I don't think I understand the question. Are you saying like what I want financially or what I want in terms of metrics for us?
Did you always set out to build? I mean, it sounds to me like you are looking at potentially the Airbnb sort of model, a company that could potentially scale that big. Did you personally want to get that big, or is it just
you require
to get that big for the company to work?
No, not at all. I want this to get to that size. I think this platform and the several other paths that I believe it can take, which nobody even knows about yet, I think is something that can operate on a global scale. I think the market in China is huge for e-commerce. I think we need to establish a presence in Asia. I think, you know, you have a demographic of people that have now quit their jobs to go travel the world, and pickups becomes the enabler of an entirely new industry, one that we call on-the-go e-commerce, where now for the first time, while shopping online and traveling, you can ship to a neighbor anywhere in the world as you're traveling. Whereas online shopping has always been restricted, historically speaking, been restricted to people that only have a fixed permanent address of some sort. So I believe this is a 190 country type of company one day, and I think there's very little getting in the way of us getting there. I think that with respect to like the revenue on a per month basis, what sucks is that like when you get into the whole VC pitching phase, obviously everything is about the metrics. In the beginning, it's like the vision, the idea, and all that, and then all of a sudden you talk to guys that you're trying to get a check from, and obviously it's all about reaching certain MRR and reaching certain, you know, what's the LTV? If you're going to offer a subscription service, what's this, what's that? There's so many metrics to factor in, so many KPIs. Mm-hmm. So I'm learning that. I'm learning that as we go, that unfortunately my role shifts from creative dude to more business dude. And I don't think I've necessarily wanted to be a businessman. There was one point where I wanted to be as a kid, but like I've realized more on the creative and design side of things is really where my strengths, not that my strengths are not in business, but that's where the happiness is. I think at this stage, I know you have to hit certain metrics to get to the next round of funding. You know, I could have very well easily said, I'm going to try to raise $2 million for a seed round. While that may be a great goal, what metrics are you operating at that commands a $2 million seed round? You know, are you doing 50K a month in monthly recurring revenue? Is there, you know, are you going 400% per week in, you know, really local areas? Like there are little things like that we need to get to that I believe a pre-seed round of a few $100,000 will get us to, given how quickly we are moving at this phase. And also the recent press we've gotten answers one major question investors always have, and that's, do people care about this? You know, is this a problem worth solving? And I think what the press helped us to do wasn't necessarily to get us a million users. No, not at all. What it did was simply answer that question. This is clearly a problem that people care about, are willing to pay to solve, and need solved now. And that pushes you 9 steps ahead, in my opinion, in the conversation with investors. Does it fix everything and like all of a sudden guarantee you success and a check? No, not at all. But it gets you somewhere, you know? So we are 100% focused on that long-term timeline.
So, I mean, you talk about, you know, getting a lot of press, and you did get a lot of press. You were on Fox, New York Times, Brooklyn Daily Edge, Fox Business News, News 12. I mean, how did you manage to put all that together? I mean, did you have connections at those places already? Because I know a lot of founders that would just, you know, their mouths would water over how much press you've received in the past 4 months. So what's the secret here, man? Tell me.
Well, first off, let me clarify. It's not even 4 months. It's actually just the last 2.5 weeks. We have Fox Business, Fox, TBS, New York Times, all that happened in the last month. None of that was, we started the company 3 months ago. I spent about a year working on the idea and researching and understanding logistics business inside and out. But 3 months ago is when we started. And then about in the last month, almost less than 3 weeks, is when all the press has happened. None of it was, there's no agency. People have asked me like, oh, so what agency are you using or what PR agency? I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I don't even know where we would even begin to have a conversation with a PR agency. I think everything has been very much just conversation with people. I this is going to sound really funny, but I literally got into an event that I should not have been at. And I got a free ticket and there were some, there was a question and answer. You know how sometimes they let the audience ask questions? And I literally asked a question to the president and CEO of the New York City Economic Development Council. And I asked them about what the city is thinking about doing regarding package theft, given that the whole topic was how delivery trucks are changing the way the city is handling transportation and creating bike lanes and all that stuff. Like, delivery trucks are now part of that conversation. And so I thought, what great opportunity then to ask about package theft. And I, you know, shamelessly took the opportunity to also plug in the company. And in the audience was a New York Times reporter. And New York Times reporter, she came up to me and afterward and blatantly asked me, she's like, what is this company? This is really interesting. You know, do you work for the company? I was like, no, I created the company. And that's literally how the conversation started. And over the subsequent few weeks, you know, I was able to provide her with people that are using our platform that could give their quotes. And she was shocked at herself. She was shocked at the magnitude of the problem. And when she started to, as any reporter does, dig deeper and call up, you know, police departments across the country and agencies across the country, you started to see that this is a massive national problem. And that's how the story came to be. And that New York Times story, ironically enough, is what ended up setting the fire for the rest of the press to come in, because it ended up being a Cyber Monday story. She ended up releasing the story on the biggest national shopping holiday in America, you know, which is like, that's like shooting a three-pointer in like the finals. Like, it's just, it was prime time. Like, she could have posted that story. And the next day it was a cover story on the, literally on the cover of the New York section in the New York Times, which is released globally. And it was a full page spread. Like, our picture is actually like takes up the whole paper. And I was shocked to even see it. Like, I was like losing my mind. And then right after that, in fact, actually when the paper came out, that's when all the other press started coming in. Because New York Times sort of set the base for that.
Again, I think this follows on to the resourcefulness factor. Which is an amazing factor. It can take you so far. It's just a leveler of everything. If you can find ways to be resourceful. And I think that another key thing that comes through what you're saying is that you believe in what you're saying, right? So it's absolutely, it's easy to sell. If the founder is truly someone that, hey, you know, I think this is a really big problem. I think that people are really going to be happy if we solve this problem. And look, we've got happy users. You know, by the way, it's a big problem. It's an emerging problem that's also growing, which means that your market is growing, right? Which is what every VC loves to hear. It's like, oh, is this a big problem now? You just wait 5 years from now. It's a bigger problem, you know. So you're able to sell that quite easily. But you know what? You know, going back to obviously the MVP phase and, you know, all the way up to where you are right now, which is, you know, early days for you still. But right. What were some of the initial challenges that you faced personally in doing this?
Are you referring to like the journey of it, like referring to me specifically, or
Well, in with regards to you, I mean, at the start, you are your company, obviously. So you are pulling all the buttons, you're pulling all the levers, you're trying to get everything done. You know, what areas did you really have to push really hard to go over those humps?
That's a great question. There's a tremendous amount of personal, there's a huge personal toll I think it takes on you. A lot of people don't talk about, mainly because it's something that maybe can be perceived as a, how do I word it? It can be sometimes talking very candidly about the downsides or the dark sides of like this process can make you sound like you're not motivated in it or fully in it, which I think is wrong given that so many, because entrepreneurship is very much, is extremely difficult. It's excruciatingly difficult, especially when you're by yourself. And so yeah, to answer the question, you know, I took time off of college, you know, school never worked for me and I never really felt like it was benefiting me in the way that I needed it to. It wasn't fulfilling. So immediately when you take that step, you're immediately judged. You know, you have all your friends that are going on to get these cushy jobs and like making really good money. And then you're sort of in the same spot, at least in your head, you know, you view yourself as like stuck, you know, because I've just worked on so many different businesses and so many different ideas that you just reach a point where you're like, something just has to work, you know, at one point. And you do get pretty desperate, I will say. You have your low points of very, very like, you know, emotional challenges and all that. It hits you very deeply. And you wonder if you'll ever, if anything will ever work, if you'll ever succeed in it, if it will ever take off, if people will care about whatever it is you're building. And 9 times out of 10 people don't. So the reality is it's the odds are stacked against you. And then you're reading about all these statistics, that 93% of startups fail. And that, you know, as a founder of color, less than 1% of capital, venture capital will go to you. And you know, I don't necessarily come from money or something like that. So I don't have a rich uncle that's going to call up his buddy at the bank and like write me $100 million check real quick. So like there's so many just things that are stacked against you. Being a young, you know, Afro-Latino entrepreneur is 100% is a reality you face. And then on top of that, you're young. So like people are automatically looking at you and thinking you're inexperienced or you don't really know what you're talking about, or you're just another, you know, young kid that is moving too quick or whatever. There's a variety of things that are that sit on your shoulders. I will say that it's hard to have a balance between, you know, this whole concept of work-life balance. I don't think it exists. At this stage, I mean, I'm 23, so I'm like, I have a family, I had like kids or something, but like, you're very much, my lifestyle revolves 100% around this company. And I don't say that negatively. I say that because it's a decision I've made, but it's 100% fair to say there is very much a lot of personal sacrifice in the development of anything, especially if you believe in some sort of a higher purpose where like, it's an existential thing for you, you know? I think you 100% have to put a lot of other things aside in that process.
So, I mean, when you're dealing with all that, and I think that, you know, a lot of founders, whether you're a founder of color, you're a Black founder, Afro-Latino founder, just founders in general, there is a certain amount of self-doubt that comes with doing this. Oh, yeah. As much as you believe in the vision, you're still, you know, there's still that voice in your head, man, what are you doing? You know, this is not going to work. I mean,
right.
Right. There's all these different things that you can tell yourself, you know, but it sounds like you're pushing through all that and just getting it done anyway. The one thing that I'm really interested about is, and I'm sure a lot of people out there who are listening to this, is how do you get the first product made? Now, I know you spoke about, you know, got a team together, got people to work with you and stuff, but what does that process really, really look like? You know, so you've got a couple of dollars, you have an idea. A lot of times people tell you, hey, find a co-founder who's technical and can build the product for you. But, you know, look, man, we're talking about, you know, the demographic people that are probably going to tune into this and the people that are part of my community and the platform don't necessarily have 10, 20 people down the road that have a CS degree and can code, right? Yeah. So how are we able to navigate that?
I laugh. I'm sorry to laugh while you were asking me the question, but like, I find it so funny when people when most of us are stuck in that position, because the majority of people are not don't have the typical cliche story of the entrepreneur, which is like, I went to Stanford and then I dropped out of Stanford and I was like, I sold my first video game at 13 or something. Like people, that's not the typical story of most. And so the vast majority are stuck in this position of, what do I do? I don't, you know, I don't have an engineer or whatnot. I think that for those listening and sort of wondering what direction to go in terms of their tech idea as an example, I think it's important to realize that it is 2019, about to be 2020 very soon. And it is literally the best time in history, in my opinion, within the tech space to be developing something. And I say this because in the early stages, when I was first brainstorming on this idea, I designed every single functionality, every idea, every feature, everything myself. And when I say design, I mean I came up with the idea of it. And then I would go and hand sketch out every page of the application, of the website, of the user experience. I'd sketch it out by hand. I bought a sketchbook and I used a ruler and just started to teach myself how I wanted this thing to look, how I envisioned it. Then I used Adobe XD, which is a prototyping software that is free. I used that to digitalize my sketches, bring them to life. And then Adobe XD lets you record the screen while using it. So you can almost create a demo of your product without it ever being ever existing. So that's one way that you can get people playing around with whatever it is you're trying to do, which gives you a lot of unique insight, which is valuable along the process. Another thing are other platforms now for web development, like Webflow, you know, where you can teach yourself these basic, they're better than regular template sites like Squarespace or whatever, but you know, Webflow gives you a little more creativity there. So I used Webflow, taught myself how to use it, and that allowed me to, you know, put a basic website up and then like get people to sign up from that and measure how quickly they sign up. You know, do you measure different metrics and see what people's feedback is like on the product as well. So it's interesting because it's like you inevitably will still need someone that can help on the tech end. But if you have a good enough idea and you're resourceful enough, there are tools out there available that will allow you to create the basic MVP. You know, a lot of the things that we did in the early stages of sort of playing around was with tools like Zapier. Zapier is an API tool that you could set up to automate an entire experience. So someone's signing up for something, Zapier sets up an automation so that an email is automatically sent to that person. And then when they click on the following thing, another automation can happen. And that's what Zapier does. It's this like long list of different automations you can implement with different tools all over the internet. So like that's an example. So yeah, there are so many different tools available now that walk you through creating the most basic versions of what you're trying to do. And I feel like in this early stages, which we're still in this stage, I think one of the most difficult things for me is you're almost watering down the idea on a daily basis. You know, it's very hard for visionaries or people that have all these ideas to focus. I can't speak for everybody else, but I know I can speak for myself. It is hard because you have all these ideas and all these things you envision this thing becoming. But at the end of the day, not everybody cares about that right now. People care about is, are you solving a problem that they need solved right now? You know, is this experience great or at least good enough to solve the problem? And am I willing to pay for it or provide some sort of exchange to use it? And so that requires you to water down the whole idea and go down to literally the bare bones. It does this for that, and it's going to do that, and that's it. Your first version is not going to look that good. You know, we're rolling out several, you know, the Chrome extension and a couple of things of our platform right now to a select amount of users, and it's probably not the most beautiful thing in the world, but it gets the job done for now. You know, I don't want to speak as if like I'm in some sort of later stage of the platform where I know I have all the answers, but I will say that based on where we are right now, that's what's helped us is really zoning in on the most basic, fundamental, like really, really elementary level aspects of the platform, and then trying to develop that in the best way you can. As per your other point about co-founders, I'm very cautious about co-founders. And I say this because, you know, I've been at this sort of journey of trying to build something that I believe can make an impact since I was like 13. So it's been like 10 years. And I've worked with dozens and dozens of people that I would refer to as quote unquote co-founders. And who knows, maybe one could argue I'm the problem. But at the same time, you quickly realize that not everybody's willing to stay up at 3 o'clock in the morning to work on something with you. And that's okay. But you can save yourself the headache by looking at it when you're about to start working on an idea, thinking first, what can I do with the resources that I have and what's on available online? What can I do with that? You know, you'd be surprised how powerful that cell phone in your hand is and that laptop in front of you. That right there is an empire in itself, you know, is an empire building tool in itself. And I think the moment I started to think like that was the moment I started to be 20 times more resourceful. I accomplished a lot more. And within a 60-day period, I was able to do a lot more than I had done with other previous businesses, where I first started off by thinking, damn, how much money do I need to do this? Or I need to go find a partner. I need to go do this. Because 9 times out of 10, you end up partnering with the wrong person. You know, no one's ever going to believe in the vision as much as you do. That's just a fact. And again, there's nothing wrong with it. You shouldn't take it personally. It's the lay of the land. It's how it works. But save yourself the headache. And sometimes you realize the majority of what you're looking for is right there in front of you.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. One thing that I often tell a lot of people who ask me about products and they need co-founders, who are technical, and I sing the same tune. I'm just like, look, you can get so much done if you just, you know, do it yourself. You know, you speak about like Webflow, Zapier, you know, there's Coda, Bubble. There's just so many tools out there.
Yeah.
But I think there's this reluctance sometimes for people to get their hands dirty, to learn things. I mean, as a founder right now, you're probably, you know, right now you're a product manager, right? Essentially, right? Yeah. And you're having to learn along the way. And you're a marketer, and you're the video guy, and you're the janitor, and you're everything. So you find that you have to learn a lot as you go along, right? And it sounds to me like you're someone that reads a lot. Yeah. And you know, what other ways are you leveraging, you know, your spare time to be able to catch up on the learning curve, right? So now you're moving into raising, you got to learn about venture funding, and you know, there's all sorts of terminologies, convertible notes, and all these other things.
Yeah.
So how are you doing that, man? Did you join like a structured program, or you know, you're just going to, you know, as you go along?
No. Let me, I don't want to say there aren't any. There are lots of programs and opportunities that you can, you know, get involved in to learn about these things if you can afford it. There are plenty of those, lots of those options in sort of educational institutions and whatnot. But in my case, you know, not necessarily having enough money to spend a couple thousand dollars joining some program or whatever, the best thing is just researching online. It's literally Googling as much as possible. I know it sounds super basic, but in reality, I watched, first off, I'm really into podcasts. So that's number one. Podcasts, you listen to other founders talk about their stories. I watch a lot of startup podcasts, How I Built This at NPR, a variety, Reid Hoffman's as well. So there's a lot of podcasts that I was listening to nonstop. And they would talk about all these terms. They would use all these terms. The CEOs would talk, like the founders would use all these terms that I just didn't understand. And I would pause the podcast and I would Google it. And then I'd find an article about it. And then I'd find 9 more articles about it. And then in every article, there was a word I didn't understand. So then I would Google that. And it just continues to spiral until like I have a page. I have a Google Doc on my email. And there's like literally 50 pages of just links. Like not even like articles, just individual size 12 font links that I just find really interesting. And I just save them. And I'll paste them on that note. And that's how most of everything I've learned in these last 12 months, because prior to that, I didn't really have an understanding of venture capital or of that world of startups and whatnot. Because you work in ideas, but once you learn the lingo of the startup community, it's a whole other animal. And so all that came from literally just researching. And then at the same time, Eventbrite, meetups, these are apps that literally give you free events. There's so many tools. I had this conversation with my dad a couple months ago, and he was just saying, it's like, it's amazing what is available to you today. You know, like when I was growing up, you know, the whole story, like when they were young type of thing, is like when I was growing up, I had to go to the library and like sit there for hours trying to research something. Meanwhile, you just pull up your laptop and in an instant, just this world of information is in front of you, you know, and we take it for granted. I'm 23, so I grew up with technology. You know, it's part of everything. you know, and my sister's, my younger sister, forget about it. She's just, it's within her DNA. But, you know, when you compare it to what people in the, in other generations had access to, it's just unbelievable. So I go to a lot of free events. I would literally just go on. And if I, you know, had a few hundred bucks saved up or whatever, I'd use that money and get myself these $10 tickets to as many events as possible. Or I'd look for free events, you know, and I'm in New York City. So New York City is the hub for everything. I mean, you know, there are events for just about anything you can possibly think of, both free and paid. And if you can't afford it, sometimes reaching out and saying, hey, is there a way I can volunteer? That's a way that I've gotten into some pretty big events as well. Just emailing and asking for volunteer opportunities, and then they give me a free ticket. Next thing you know, I meet my future investor at that event, or my future mentor, or an engineer. I've met engineers at events that I really shouldn't have been at either. So it's things like that. It's a, I guess going back to your original point of being resourceful, like the last 2 years have, the last year and a half has taught me that more than anything else. It's everything that you need sometimes is literally right in front of you. It's not as far into the future as you think. It's a phone call away or a Google search away. You know, it's all there.
Yeah, no, I definitely see where you're coming from with that one. I think there's just ample amount of resources. Honestly, sometimes to the point where I personally feel like you just have too much of it, right? So almost making a decision as to what to do becomes a problem in itself. It's like, okay, so what do I do now? It's like you have all these different tools. A lot of them do the same thing.
And you like you focus. Mentioned,
you lose focus. You know, I dive into that rabbit hole myself where 50 tabs later and I'm just like sitting there and then it becomes a tab closing contest. Okay, I gotta shrink down now. And it's like anxiety of which one to close. And okay, I got to save this to pocket. And it becomes a thing. Yeah. But I think there's something to always think about, which is go for the simplest option, right? Like if go for the simplest one, go for the one that's going to cost you the least amount of money and overhead and friction to get something done. So, you know, talking about getting something done, what's the next step for you right now? You know, you're at this point where you have this MVP, you know, you've got all this press, so you've got a, you know, a little bit of traction there. Are you making revenue yet?
Right now we're entirely focused on pumping every dollar we make back into the business. So if that, I don't know if that answers the question, but any sort of transactions we've conducted with users has been funneled right back into improving the experience and marketing and all that. So we're moving along, but we're pumping it right back in.
And right now you're just solely based in New York, right?
Correct. So just the Brooklyn, the Williamsburg area of Brooklyn in New York. Brooklyn. So we're very, very hyper local.
Yes, hyper local for sure. I think platforms like yours and I would say Airbnb is when I can compare it with. They're global, but they feel hyper local. And I think
it's called Glocal. Yep.
Glocal, right? There you go. It,
yeah.
So I think that making it have this feeling of hyper-local is very, very important in, I think, the success of things like this. Yeah. Do you think that, you know, a platform like yours will only work in big cities?
No. I think there are a few different ways to look at this. The first is from a urban versus suburban environment perspective, right? And so in that end of things, it's easy to see how this would work in a big city like New York or San Francisco or whatnot, right? But if you head over to the suburbs, they have the same problem. You know, they're called porch pirates, where there are people that follow the UPS trucks and the delivery trucks, and they wait for them to be delivered, and they go and they grab the package, and they're on their merry way. The challenge in the suburban area is that you have more land to cover, quite literally. So it's not as, you know, the way you'd set up, let's say, pick up neighbors in suburban areas would be a little more I know the person kind of thing than it is where in the city where, like, there's just thousands and thousands of people on every city street. I mean, there are 72,000 people per square mile living in New York City. So that just gives you some perspective on the amount of people that you can possibly have as shoppers or neighbors or whatever. But in areas like suburban America, it's different. You know, you're not going to travel you're not necessarily going to travel very far to go see your neighbor, but at the same time, you have a vehicle. So you can do more than a 10 block radius, you know, whereas in New York City, our radius for neighbors is usually about 5 to 6 blocks around your important place. So there's that perspective, right? So we could work in a suburban area. You just have to make modifications to the way that you would onboard users and the way that the user experience would work, given that people are mainly going to commute with via, you know, their vehicles and cars and whatnot, unless it's someone that's across the street for them, as an example. Now, the other side of that that spectrum is in the sort of income, not income, but I would say like third world versus, you know, first world. One of the biggest challenges, I think, on a global scale is that logistically speaking, the infrastructure is not set in place to sustain e-commerce in a lot of countries around the world. You know, e-commerce has not taken off in every country in the world, not because it's not something that people, that is something that people don't want. It's more like the logistical infrastructure is lacking. You know, there are many, addressing is a major problem as well in a lot of these countries. So I know that one of the challenges we're going to personally experience is in that space, enabling people to travel to, you know, a third world country and be able to shop online and deliver to a neighbor may be difficult simply because a lot of these countries still have, their addressing system doesn't exist. You know, a lot of these countries still, like, signs are just random numbers or whatever. So those are the, some of the other spaces that pickups can work, where it's in like smaller cities or big cities in these third world countries. But it's all a matter of what our long-term vision is and how we can sort of impact those other spaces as well. But we can work across the board, from first world to third world countries, from suburbia to urban environments. It's just a matter of tinkering and sort of adapting to the problems that come with each sector.
Right. And that's something that you're gonna move into organically rather than just target a market and just dive in there and say, what can we do here? Or you'd rather just grow into those markets organically, right?
Oh, completely. Yeah. I think that's the, ironically enough, you were talking about like being resourceful. That's the change, actually, is completely everything being grassroots and organic. That's the most efficient, most effective form of growing. It's also capital efficient. You know, it's, you think about the kind of, like, as an example, the press that we've gotten, we've spent a whopping $0. A whole $0 have been spent to develop this, you know, to get the press that we've gotten. It's just been talking to people and getting them to see that this is a real problem and then them wanting to share with others. It's cost us nothing, you know, and that's, I think, the approach that everybody should take. I think I'm glad, I know it sounds weird to say this, but I'm glad that I didn't, this is a weird statement, but because nobody would ever say this, but I'm glad
don't
I
say it. Actually. Don't say it. Don't say it. Don't say it, man. I'm telling you, don't say it.
I mean, okay. Well, all I'm saying is just being resourceful really does make you think outside the box. You know, when you got to really dig a little deeper and you don't necessarily have all the tools available, it forces you to dig deep. It forces you to see things from a different perspective and flip over rocks that maybe you would not. You know what I mean? That's what I was trying to say, I guess, in a nutshell.
No, I hear you. I hear you, man. I know exactly where you're going with that one. So it sounds to me like you got everything together right now, or it seems from the outside.
It's
the duck and water situation where it's like calm on the surface and underneath you just paddling for dear life.
Right.
What are some of the threats that you have outlined as, hey, man, if this happens, we're done. You know, we're packing up tomorrow, right? You know, if you can just share with us some of the things that you have identified that could potentially threaten your growth or, you know, the product that you're working on. Or who is your threat?
Threats that, interest. That's a good question. I think local governments could become a potential problem in the future. I don't think at this stage they're an issue for us, but like any sharing economy platform, you have to prepare for the backlash. You know, the taxi medallions got very much involved in politics when Uber came into the picture because it was destroying their business. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, local governments went to bat for them and they got into a lot of trouble there. Now, I'm not also making an excuse for Uber. I'm sure they had their other issues that created these problems as well. But I'm just saying that local governments and regulatory bodies do get in the way of sharing economy companies. So I'm sure, I don't think it would be the end of our company. I think it's important to, as a way to avoid that, is to build relationships with local governments from the beginning, even at early stages like ours. I think you know, we're getting into conversation with the city council and working with community leaders and local police departments in these neighborhoods that we're going about expanding, establishing a presence in, mainly because it allows them to see that, listen, we're not, there's not them versus, you know, us versus them kind of thing. It's we're all in this together. At the end of the day, package theft is a problem that takes police resources, you know, law enforcement resources. Congestion causes millions of dollars a year in losses for cities, you know, in addition to pollution. There's just a variety of benefits that come with getting people to commute more, getting people to work together more, and getting people to know each other more in these neighborhoods and communities. And so for us, working with local governments is, I think, number one. But at the same time, I think if we were to fail to not do that efficiently or effectively, that would cause a major problem for us in the future. In the same way that Lyft and Uber right now are being sued by like every city in the world because they decided to leave them out of the conversation. You know, they left them out of this whole, we're going to take over the transportation movement, you know, or world in all these cities, and we're not going to involve the local governments in it at all. So I think it's important to maintain that dialogue. And I think if we do that well, we won't have that problem.
So, I mean, one of the things that I've learned recently, and I said recently because it finally clicked, is as a founder, you literally have to be a storyteller, right? You have to tell the same story using a different narrative to, depending on who you're talking to, right? And you have to be very good at that. And you're just selling stories, right? You're telling these stories, you're getting people to realize how the problem affects them and why they should get involved. And it seems like you're very good at that. Now, how did you get to that point where you can effectively articulate and tell these stories in the way that you're doing to get people really interested in this? Because it's a very hard skill to get, mind you. It's not something that comes natural. And it seems like it comes natural to you. Is there something that, you know, in your background, maybe you were younger or the earlier days, something that you had to do for survival? Because it comes very naturally, and I'm quite impressed. And I really want to know how you got to that point.
Well, I appreciate that, man. It means a lot, you saying that. It's weird to answer that because it's like you don't necessarily ever think you're good at that. You just talk, you know, you just sort of throw it out there and there's no real strategy. I will say that when I was growing up, I was very much to myself. You know, I wasn't necessarily the most popular guy in the class. I didn't have a lot of friends. And so I spent a lot of time just journaling and creating a sort of world in my own head of what I think things would be like or things should be like. And then for sometimes moments of the day, I almost close my eyes and I daydream a lot. Sometimes I zone out often. That's a problem that I have. And it's mainly because I'm dreaming something about something. It's really weird. But that sort of imagination is what allows me to see the story, the ending to the story, if that makes sense. And I feel like if you can see the ending to a story, it helps you to work backwards. I don't know if that makes any sense, but for me, that's how my brain works. So that's something that has definitely helped me to at least create a version of the world in my head and the ideas that I want to develop. In terms of the way to articulate it, I think doing your homework makes it easier. And what I mean by that is, I am able to describe the logistics industry or talk about the problem or talk about the challenges in the industry and all these different things because I've spent a year studying it, you know, because I've spent months and hours and a lot of sleepless nights trying to understand why it exists in the first place. A lot of people wouldn't do that. Oftentimes, in my opinion, I think people skip that process because they think it's like, well, what if this idea doesn't work? And now I would have spent all this time researching it. Let me go focus on why. Like, let me just go jump in and talk to people about the problem. And I feel like I'm glad that I actually didn't talk to anybody for several months. I didn't talk to anybody about this idea. I didn't ask anybody any questions. I just researched. I researched to understand everything, the statistics, the challenges, the where the future is heading. You know, they write so many articles about where logistics is heading because of Amazon or because of this, because of that. So there's so much data online. And so I spent a lot of time reading all about that. And then thinking more deeply into the idea, understanding what my long-term vision is, and marrying all that together helps me to then communicate it because now I feel like I know the facts. And I don't know everything, but I know enough to get to communicate, you know, why somebody should care about it. And then I spent a lot of time looking into, you know, my idols. I know it sounds kind of weird to say that, but everybody says they have some idols. You know, I really look up to people like Elon Musk I've never obviously seen it in the modern day Walt Disney, but like seeing the way the Disney company carries itself and sort of tells stories for that's what the whole purpose is. And so following things like that and listening to my idols, and a lot of these entrepreneurs and people that have made a significant impact in the world, seeing how they describe their vision, it's helped me to better understand mine, you know? And I guess maybe that has helped me to communicate.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that you definitely can learn a lot from listening to the stories of other people, especially other great entrepreneurs. I remember someone asked me very recently, was like, you know, how do you do something similar to this? Now, how do you tell stories? How do you communicate? How do you simplify? They were trying to explain to me, you know, what their startup does offline and stuff. And I was like, man, I'm just not getting this. You know, you're really going around in circles. And, you know, to an extent where the person got a little bit frustrated, and I get that. And I'm like, you know what? I was like, you know what? Do me a favor. When you go home, just listen to Steve Jobs talk. Like, just don't go read any book. Just listen to Steve Jobs. You're not interested in computers, but just listen to Steve Jobs talk about computers. And you know, he obviously had a great way of talking about things that are very complicated and just making them feel simple and get you to care about computer stuff. And I think that it's a skill that every founder should have. And I think that it's a skill that every human being should have, right? Because we're moving into this stage where everybody, you know, you are your own personal brand now. So you have to tell a story, right? Or that's like essential for survival, essentially, in the business world.
Yeah. And I mean, just to add on to that as well, like people don't buy things. They buy the emotion that comes with owning it. You know, they buy into you as a person, and then you're leading them into why they should have whatever it is you're selling them, you know, and that's, and that is something that I've learned from watching exactly what you just said. You painted it perfectly, like watching Steve Jobs, watching Elon Musk or Bob Iger from Disney, or watching the, you know, CEOs of the top, you know, Fortune 100 companies, or listening to Jay-Z talk about, you know, hustle and the journey and all those things. Like I literally have spent hours and days just watching videos of people. I know it sounds weird to say this, but it's 100% what I've done a lot of. And at the same time, when you watch these people and you see how they communicate their vision, how they simplify things, then you start to understand like, oh, okay, so this is how I should communicate this. And what you just mentioned about the sort of elevator pitch or summing up the company, it took me close to 3 weeks, I would say, to sit of just sitting down stuck for days trying to figure out. No, I kid you not.
I believe you. I honestly 100% believe you. I really do.
Figuring out like a 30-second pitch, which is like 5 or 6 sentences, took me 3 weeks, you know, because it's like, how do you paint this picture? Because you have all these ideas, right? That's the one thing that that always hurts entrepreneurs. Like, you have all these grand ideas.
You have to trim it down.
You have to water that down and bring it to the most basic level where, like my dad says, an 8-year-old can understand it and your grandmother can understand it at the same time, you know? And that is what it's so hard to do, but once you do it, it really makes life a lot easier. And then I started to work backwards from there.
So honestly, I think that one of the reasons why I think that that process is very important, at least from my perspective, is that essentially you should think about it as a bunch of features, right? The more scattered the ideas are, the more scattered the vision is, the more features your product is going to have from the jump, right? But in doing that mental process, it's almost like a mental model of compressing that idea down. You essentially removing, you know, features out of this product to start off with. And once you nail exactly what you're doing down with regards to, you know, 3 to 5 sentences of probably even 3 or 2 of what you're doing, then your MVP becomes something that's not bloated and it's super simple. And I think that a lot more founders or aspiring founders going into this should consider that, hey, I really have to work on this messaging thing, because once that's done, then I know what I'm building.
Right, right. And another thing to add to that as well is I think it's really important for any founder today. And by the way, again, I don't want to speak as if I know all the answers. I don't. I'm learning myself. But like one of the things that I think is super important is to realize the age of communication that we're living in right now. You know, the way we consume information has changed fundamentally than the way we consumed information just 10 years ago. And that has impacted entrepreneurship extremely, you know, on a fundamental level. And the reason I say is because, you know, you got to look at a couple of things. We, you know, 10 years ago, for some of the press that we've gotten recently, you know, we're talking about having to hire a PR agency and all this type of stuff. And it's a whole mission in the process to figure out the angle and this and that, whatever. Meanwhile, in this particular case, you know, all we've been doing is telling the story about the problem we have that we're trying to solve. All we've been doing is communicating, hey, is this something you've experienced? Okay, great. Well, here's why we're trying to solve it. And here's what we're doing. And here's what you can do to start using it right now. We're really early and we're a small startup out of Brooklyn, but if this problem is something that you believe is worth solving, sign up here and here it is. And that's what we've been doing. And look how many people we've been able to sort of bring our way and bring into the community and all that great stuff. So it just goes to show you the point I'm trying to make by mentioning this is that today, starting with storytelling and starting with zoning in on your ability to communicate your vision and your idea is actually the starting point for then building it. Ironically enough, because if that's how you can figure out people care about it. And that's why we started off with the commercial. I had an investor that told me, he was like, you know, it's really weird that your first guy on the team was not an engineer, given that you're not an engineer. It was a content guy. I was like, yeah, it's because it's 2019 and consumers view things, they don't judge things just by the tech behind it now. They judge it by, how do I feel about this company? You know, is it motivating me? Where is this being sourced? You know, as consumers, are what motivates us has changed fundamentally. And so if we can build a brand that people love and people trust and people see that we're really actually solving the problem, it doesn't matter what kind of tech we create. What matters is that we just connect with people, you know, and that's more important than anything. And if as a founder, if you can master that, not that I've mastered it, I haven't at all, but if you can even get close to it, like, I feel like that really helps. And I can tell you from experience, it's helping. It's helping right now, you know?
Yeah, so I definitely agree with that because sort of the way I look at it is that we're moving to the point now where it's almost to the stage where the product, building the product now is more of a commodity, right? You know, in certain areas of the world, you throw a stone out there, you can find a developer. But, you know, building a brand, getting the good story together, getting the right team around, getting the right content out there, is almost the hard parts now, right? The product, you know you're going to build the product, right? I'm pretty sure you are definitely confident that you're going to get the product side of things done because for the most part, it's not extremely complicated, right? You're not writing a new compiler. You're not building a new browser. It's the product can be done, but it's everything else. And I think that people need to realize that even if you're not a technical founder, if you don't have technical co-founders, or even if you're a solo founder, you can get so much done. And in doing all of that, you're going to have the technical people knocking on your door saying, hey, I want to join this team, right? So I think that going in search of the technical co-founder, the holy grail, is definitely a rat race. And I think that people can get a lot done without a technical co-founder.
Absolutely. I don't have one. You know, I, like I said, you put it perfectly. I don't have a technical co-founder. We're a team of, you know, six or seven people. And we are literally just motivated entirely by the vision, the idea, and the potential of the impact that it can make. And I don't have, like I said, it's very important to emphasize, I'm a 23-year-old with no experience in developing software, and I'm building a software-focused company. So it just goes to show you, if you have the vision, you've done your homework, and you really have a focus on where it's going to go, you can convince others of that as well. And that, I think, is the most important thing.
So just to touch on that, saying that you're 23, I think there's a lot of other 23-year-olds out there, or probably even 25, 28, doesn't matter, right, that are looking to potentially start a business. I guess the simple question is why, and maybe they're on the fence, right? They go, man, I want to start a business, I'm not sure. You know, the risk, the reward, you know, in simple terms, you know, why should anyone make that leap of faith. You know, you've taken that leap of faith. You're in it now. Your head down. You know, you've got your boots planted in there. You're not getting out of it anytime soon. Why do you think other people should actually go out there and start a business, especially a startup?
I think it depends on what motivates you. You know, it's rare that you, not necessarily rare, but it's important to first realize what your passion is. I think if you can find something that you enjoy doing, that's a great place to start. I don't believe it's that simple though, because I personally don't know what I want to do with my life. Actually, ironically enough, I know that I'm motivated by this. I'm motivated by wanting to work on things that make an impact. And this stuff is really exciting for me, but not everybody can find that. You know, some people are literally looking at it from a more, draw out a web and find a business type of thing, which is fine too. And if that's the approach, then solve a problem. I think the world is, while every industry is growing so rapidly and so quickly, and there are so many new this and so many new that, as great as that is, there are problems that come along with it. And I think if you can find a problem that requires a solution, and there are lots of problems in the world, that's for sure, there's a business. A problem that requires a solution and finding a creative way to monetize it, you've got yourself a business. And that problem doesn't have to be something grandiose like solving world hunger, or like, you know, I don't know, stopping package theft in every city in the world. It doesn't necessarily have to, you know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't have to be like that. Being able to, you know, solve an issue that affects a group of people in your neighborhood or a specific demographic of people today anywhere around the world, that's a business. I know it sounds so basic, but it's really that. I feel like entrepreneurship, people complicate it. Because it's extraordinarily difficult, but it's not because starting is difficult, in my opinion. I think it's staying in it is difficult, because this will test you. This will bring you to a very low point where you're just like, man, can I really do this? You know, can I actually succeed? Is this way above my head or whatever? Like, that's where the difficulty comes in. In my opinion, starting off is really sitting down and saying, what are my skill sets? You know, what are my passions? What do I enjoy? What interests me? What's fascinating? You know, and what are the problems in the world? And what are some ideas for how I can bring it to life, a solution to life? And that's, I think, where what should motivate you. I think if you're chasing money 100%, just the idea of making a dollar, you're not going to get very far. Everybody's different. Some people may have the tenacity and the hustle to turn a dollar into 10. That's great. I never quite had that talent. So I can only speak for myself, but I just know that in the days, like when I was in the nightlife business, that everything is about closing a transaction, of course, selling a bottle service or a VIP table or whatever. And everything was about chasing money. I was never happy. I never quite was able to accomplish that much, actually, to be honest with you. And I felt very limited and unfulfilled. And yet here I go working on an idea that I think has a bigger purpose. Granted, package theft is not the most exciting thing on earth. Logistics, believe me, it's not like the craziest Friday night. But the idea of solving a problem that is connected to a much greater purpose for me is it's exciting, man. It really is. Pumps me up.
Well, look, man, I'm pumped up about package theft right now, really, just listening to you talk about it. So you're definitely doing something right, because now I'm thinking to myself, man, package theft is a really big problem. I mean, I'm going to be talking about this for the next couple of days now. Hey, did you know package theft is a really big problem? You know, I got all these stats now, you know, 90,000 packages a day.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'm going to sound so smart and cool around the water cooler now.
Listen, you know what's crazy? If you walk around New York City, I find myself now, my friends tell me, they're like, dude, you know, you're obsessed with this thing now. I'm like, what are you talking about? Every building I walk by, I could be in a whole conversation with somebody and my eyes automatically shift to look at the floor in the lobby of the building, because you can see it from the door. Every building I walk by, and if I see packages, I have to stop and take a picture. And I take a picture and I post it. So all my friends are like, there's a package there. I know you saw it. You want to go take a picture of it? I'm like, yes, I'll be right back.
Everyone's going to send you package pictures from now on.
literally. So it just, you'd be surprised, man. It becomes a whole part of you. So,
oh, man, trust me. I know all about that, right? You start thinking in packages. All right. So, you know, last thing is, a year from now, where are you?
A year from now. A year from now, I think we've gained 100% presence in New York City. I think we'd be in the five boroughs. our goal of several thousand neighbors in the New York City area, and we're figuring out our next city in 1 year. I think we're moving on to our next city.
Are you venture funded by then?
Absolutely. We have raised our seed round of funding. We're in a pre-seed right now, but we're raised our seed round of funding. Hopefully we got a little shop. We've got a great team of engineers and content creators, and we've established a significant presence in New York. I think once you sort of hit New York, you can really pretty much quickly expand to other cities around the world and around the country. But I do want to be venture funded at the seed level. I want to have, established a significant presence in New York and maybe a little early presence in other areas like San Francisco and Chicago, where this problem is just as bad. And hopefully we got a great team of people that are equally as passionate and driven and determined as I am.
Man, I can't tell you how pumped up I am about Package Theft right now. I'm really looking forward to seeing you grow and, watching your company grow, which I'll probably keep my eyes on it as always. And, watch you grow as a founder, as a young founder. It's definitely exciting. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I know someday this podcast is going to be worth a lot of money because it's going to be.
I hope so, right?
right. That's my gamble. It's like one of these guests is going to be big one day, right? Which one is it? But you're definitely doing something exciting. I like where you're going with this. Head's in the right place. And, I wish you all the best. And look, man, if anybody else out there wants to reach out to you, how can they find out where you are? Where do you hang out in real life, online? How can they contact you?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I am on the A train every day in New York City. So if you're taking the A train, you will probably see me. As per reaching out online, usepickups.com is our website. You can find us on social media at usepickups across Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. My personal social media is State of Gabriel. You can find me on Instagram or Twitter, and you can also reach me on my email is on my Instagram. Like, you could reach out to me. I respond to DMs and emails all the time, and LinkedIn as well. So totally open book, open to conversation with anybody.
All right, Gabriel. Thank you very much. Very excited.
Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
Not a problem. Take care, man.